Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back on The Punch Out, 28th of September, 2021. Very happy to be back with you here on the show. And we've got plenty for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to be talking about a death penalty travesty in Texas. We're going to be talking about Sudan, a nation that is facing quite a bit of turmoil right now. But before we get to either of those two very important stories, we're going to start with Kristen Sinema and some of her donors that seem to hate many of the budget proposals in Congress right now. Kristen Sinema, Senator from Arizona, Democratic Senator from Arizona, has become one of the key roadblocks to Congress passing a $3.5 trillion budget bill that contains a range of provisions from free community college, universal pre-K, a few hundred dollars a month for families, a clean electricity standard by 2030, 80% by 2030, and expanded Medicare coverage, among other things. And many have wondered exactly why she is so vociferously against this. I mean, one, just on basic human and moral grounds, given the nature of the bill, why would anyone who doesn't hate people be opposed to, say, increasing wages and improving conditions in long-term care facilities, or $80 billion for public housing, where there's a $70 billion backlog in repairs that have turned a lot of our public housing residences into slums, or the $90 billion slated for rental assistance? You also may ask why she would be opposed just on opportunistic electoral grounds, because these policies are all very popular in the state of Arizona, the state she represents. 65% of voters polled by Data for Progress supported the budget bill earlier this summer when they were asked. 95% of Democrats and even 43% of Republicans in Arizona were in support. When you break down some of the individual issues here, it's even more stark. 85% of those polled, for instance, supported Medicare expansion. 85% also supported investments in long-term care. 71% supported investments in child care, and 75% supported higher taxes on the wealthy to pay for it all. So why would Senator Sinema be opposed to this? Well, here's one clue for you. The New York Times recently reported that, quote, Senator Kristen Sinema of Arizona, the inscrutable Democrat who may hold the key to passing her party's ambitious social policy and climate bill, is scheduled to have a fundraiser on Tuesday afternoon with five business lobbying groups, many of whom fiercely opposed the bill. Ah, there we go. Money in politics. The Times goes on to further note, quote, under Ms. Sinema's political logo, the influential National Association of Wholesaler Distributors and the Grocers Pack, along with lobbyists for roofers and electrical contractors and a small business group called the S-Corp Political Action Committee, have invited association members to an undisclosed location on Tuesday afternoon for 45 minutes to write checks for between $1,000 and $5,800 payable to Sinema for Arizona. And just for good measure, the Times also adds, quote, Ms. Sinema has privately told Senate Democratic colleagues that she is averse to the corporate and individual tax rate increases that both the House and Senate tax writing committees have planned to use to help pay for the measure. And, hey, funny, what do you know? The people hosting the fundraiser agree with her on that issue of taxes. The S-Corp PAC, and by the way, S-Corp is a type of corporation that essentially pays lower taxes, said that the tax increases would, quote, kneecap private companies. The National Association of Wholesaler Distributors said that passing the budget bill is the, quote, last thing Washington should be doing. The National Grocers Association, in a message to their members titled The Tax Man Cometh, described the tax increases as the government coming for a, quote, pound of flesh. So no wonder Sinema is trying to tank the bill no matter who it helps and no matter how popular it is. It's clear she isn't really calling the shots, but just acting as the puppet for big businesses that are really pulling the strings. Well, you almost certainly did not hear about it. Over the weekend, the oil business in Sudan ground to a halt as huge protests in eastern Sudan blocked oil shipments as well as roads. And the issue also comes as at least one coup was attempted in Sudan last week, with perhaps another one on the way, as the governing coalition, heavily controlled by certain military factions, struggles to bring the country together. Now, as of today, protesters have allowed oil flows to resume, but are still in a state of mobilization while considering an offer to end the standoff from the government, leaving many to think the situation could flare up again at a moment's notice. There are a few different issues intertwined here, but the principal issue is the aftermath of the 2019 Sudanese Revolution, as it's known there, where huge mass protests, the stubborn continuation of several armed insurgencies in different parts of the country, and discontent in the government apparatus itself led a section of the military to overthrow Omar al-Bashir, the longtime leader of the country. The movement had a range of different currents, however, and after military elements seized power, they quickly splintered the various currents of the broader movement. Some civilian forces and armed groups joined with the new government. Others, including the prominent Communist Party, remained in opposition. And at times, it can seem like some forces sort of float in and out of supporting the government. Last week, at least, according to the government itself, disgruntled forces in the military allegedly affiliated with the former Bashir government attempted to seize power and failed. The Communist Party noted that the coup was the result of the lack of follow-through on elements of the alleged transition, in particular the maintenance of various militias, including the ones upholding the government, as well as failing to restructure the military and properly punish those who had planned previous coups. So basically that ultimately the government had set up a situation laying the groundwork for ongoing palace coup-type situations. The issues in the east flow from a long-running dispute in the region. Residents, particularly those of the Beja tribe, have long been denied access to public resources, despite the fact that a huge amount of the country's oil wealth flows through the region to Port Sudan. Since the 1970s, successive Sudanese governments have appropriated land from the Beja for large-scale plantation schemes, and schools and healthcare are essentially non-existent. Some estimates say illiteracy is as high as 90%. And the Beja have been fighting for their rights for some time through various means. In 2005, the Port Sudan massacre saw over 20 Beja protesters massacred and hundreds arrested. Late last year, the Sudanese government signed a peace deal with several armed groups in the eastern part of Sudan, but the Beja leaders said that their concerns were left out, and getting them heard is a big part of what's behind the current protest. Beja leaders are demanding the dismantling of this agreement and establishing a new one with stronger wealth and power-sharing arrangements that create more fairness and equality in the region. Beja forces have also said that if these demands can't be met, they would also like to see self-determination for the region as well. In the past, this has actually been very consistent because in the past there have been similar calls for self-determination and independence from forces in the Beja region. Sudan remains on a knife's edge moving forward as some elements of the civilian government had their security detachments withdrawn by the military and with quite a bit of jockeying going on at the top of the government between various groups of civilians and various groups of military people. The Sudanese government has become a particular ally of the United States as it changed the country's support for Palestine to support for Israeli apartheid, and they've also been backing U.S. moves to pressure Ethiopia and Eritrea over the conflict there in northern Ethiopia. And surprise, surprise, many people are trying to blame Eritrea for what's happening in East Sudan rather than the long-running and deeply rooted disputes that exist amongst the Beja and other people. So undoubtedly, though, the government in Sudan is hoping that their support for Israel and their support for the U.S. attempts to promote disunity in the Horn of Africa will give some cover to them to enforce their writ in the East and with certain elements of the transitional government. Ultimately, the Sudanese conflict reflects many of the challenges facing a range of African countries, where the combination of colonial borders, thousands of years of ethnic and cultural heritage, and resources being hoarded by a few elites backed by international actors combine to create potent brews that explode into broader conflicts. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has vacated the conviction of Clinton Young, who is on Texas's death row, and his case is indicative of many issues at the heart of the problems with the U.S. criminal legal system, in particular prosecutorial misconduct and corruption. The appeals court noted, quote, judicial and prosecutorial misconduct in the form of an undisclosed employment relationship between the trial judge and the prosecutor appearing before him tainted the applicant's entire process from the outset. The evidence presented in this case support only one legal conclusion, that the applicant was deprived of his due process rights to a fair trial and an impartial judge, end quote. Young was convicted in 2003 of killing two men for the use of their vehicle for what was alleged to be a two-day crime spree. Young, from the outset, said he was framed. The prosecution's key witness was the person Young said actually did it. And notably, there was gunshot residue on this witness's gloves and affidavits from four prisoners who had been locked up with him that said he bragged about not only killing the two men, but framing Young. In fact, that same witness later admitted in an interview with another prosecutor that he did, in fact, frame Young. Both of these sets of evidence, the gunshot residue, the affidavits from the four prisoners, and the guy's own confession that he framed Young, were kept secret. Now, amazingly, throughout almost the entire process, the prosecutor who prosecuted Young was also working as a researcher who made legal recommendations to the court about how to handle appeals and got paid for it. So essentially, the prosecutor was prosecuting people, and then once they were convicted, doing the research and making the recommendations to the judges about how to rule on their appeals. And of course, if they're doing this work as a legal clerk for a judge, judges are, you know, feel positively about that. It helps them do their job. So beyond just the part of, you know, prosecuting someone and then ruling on their appeal, which makes it easier to cover things up, you've got the issue of basically a judge looking favorably on a prosecutor who's also helping them out in terms of their caseload moving forward. So in this case, just amazingly, the trial judge in Young's trial was the judge that that prosecutor was working for in this second role. So the prosecutor prosecutes Young, didn't produce all the relevant evidence, and then advised on his appeals to make sure the evidence stayed hidden and got paid for both. That prosecutor has now lost his law license. Let's hope that Young's new trial gets him off, but the deeper issues do remain. As the Death Penalty Information Center notes, quote, of the 185 exonerations that have occurred since 1973, and these are death penalty exonerations, 69.2% have included official misconduct by police, prosecutors, or other government officials. Official misconduct was much more likely in cases involving defendants of color, cases in which exonerations took two decades or more, and cases in which DNA evidence was a significant factor in proving innocence. Misconduct was a factor in more than three-quarters of the cases in which black defendants were exonerated, 78.8%, and more than two-thirds of cases involving Latino people, 68.8%. Misconduct occurred in 55.6% of the 99 cases in which exoneration took a decade or less, rising to 81.1% in exonerations taking 11 to 20 years, 88% in the cases in which exoneration took 21 to 30 years, and in all eight of the exonerations that took more than three decades. Now, if you're wondering why that's very, very significant, if you think about it like this, it means that these were the cases that were being actively covered up, and that's why it's taking so long to exonerate people, and the longer it takes, the more likely there is misconduct, because if you know you did wrong, you're going to try to make sure that all of that remains buried and hidden. And misconduct was present in 85.7% of the cases in which DNA evidence contributed to proving a death row exoneree's innocence, suggesting that the denial of DNA testing or absence of DNA evidence has caused innocence to be undetected or contributed to the denial of relief in other innocence cases. Well, that's justice, American style for you. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York, East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles, Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.